Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Carla sucked in her breath and grimaced as she watched her 15-year-old son limp off the soccer field to the bench. Well, she remarked to a teammate's father standing next to her, at least this team has a good trainer. At the end of the game, her son Will came over the bleachers, dragging his injured leg.
Hey!
He smiled his cockeyed grin, face still decorated with grime and sweat.
Like the game?
His mom tried a half-hearted smile. I'm sort of worried about your ankle. How does it feel?
Ah, it's okay. Just played through it most of the game.
Just played through it? How long was it injured before you came out? Did it get hurt when you collided with that defender at the beginning of the game? What did the trainer say? Does the coach know you played with an injury? She just couldn't stop her torrent of questions.
Ah, Mom, Will replied. It's not that big a deal. Everyone does it.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about sports safety for our kids? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest knows all about sports injuries and the kids who get them. Dr. Barry Bowden is an orthopedic surgeon working in sports medicine in Rockville, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. His experience also includes academic research and active professional organizational involvement. He has a 6-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Bowden.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start off asking you what the most common sports injury you treat is.
Overall, I would say the most common sports injury is an ankle sprain, just like the story which you just told. Very, very common. Fortunately, they're not really serious injuries. Most people can get back from ankle sprains and play sports without a problem.
But not 10 minutes after it happens.
Not 10 minutes after it happens. That's a little unusual. I mean, that was one tough kid that you were describing in that story. Most of the time when people sprain their ankle, they go down and they don't feel like continuing with the game. We see a lot of ankle sprains. An ankle sprain is basically a strain to the ligament, and it usually occurs on the outside part of the ankle. The way that we treat it is with the RICE protocol, which so many of you have probably heard about. R standing for rest, I for ice, C for compression, and E for elevation. And if somebody sprains an ankle during a game, that's what you should be doing on the sidelines. And then make an appointment to see the doctor. You can never tell for sure if there's an ankle fracture. And that's the one thing we worry about. So, you know, if it's a serious ankle sprain, they should come in, they should see the doctor, get an x-ray, make sure there isn't an ankle fracture. And if it's a sprain, we usually just support it with a brace for a couple weeks. Depends on how serious the sprain is. And then we start the rehabilitation program.
Now, you talked about the kid in the story as one tough customer. Is there a difference between girls and boys in terms of the kinds of injuries they get?
Overall, injuries tend to be very similar, but there are certain specific injuries that are more common in one sex versus the other. And the one that comes to mind is ACL injuries, which stands for anterior cruciate ligament injuries. Been hearing a lot about this injury in the press lately. Almost every weekend you hear about another football player that tears his ACL and is out for the season.
Where is the ACL?
The ACL is one of the four critical ligaments in the knee, and it sits right in the middle of the knee. And it just so happens that these injuries are much more common in women than in men. There have been studies over the last 5 to 10 years showing that these injuries are 2 to 8-fold more common in females than in males.
Why is that?
There are a number of theories that try to explain why that is. And they can be divided up basically into a couple different categories. What scientists are doing is looking at what are the differences between men and women. Is the easiest way to look at that to try to figure out why they're injuring their ACL so much more frequently. Well, the difference is one, anatomic. there are some differences in the anatomy between men and women. Women have wider hips. They tend to be more knock-kneed. And so that may predispose females to tearing their ACL. There are hormonal differences. There's been a lot of research looking at estrogen. And maybe estrogen, because it can cause ligamentous laxity, maybe it causes some laxity or looseness to the ligament and predisposes to an injury. The hot topic, which is where we're looking the closest right now, is what we call the neuromuscular differences between men and women. And there have been a number of studies come out over the last few years that show there are definitely some differences in men and women. And when I say neuromuscular, what I'm talking about, how the nerves control the muscles, how the brain controls the muscles around the knees. And when you think about it, we have these pre-programmed motor patterns in our brain that send out signals to the muscles around the knee to protect them when you play sports. When you think about it, it's almost amazing we don't get injured more often, because every time you go out and play soccer, football, basketball, you're cutting, twisting, pivoting thousands of times. And the vast majority of the time, people don't get injured. Well, what happens when these motor patterns go a little haywire? Remember, these patterns are reacting in split seconds. All right, we're talking, you know, milliseconds. And when you're playing team sports, something can happen where you get bumped, where you get jarred, where the ball deflects or you step in a hole, and maybe those motor patterns go a little haywire and the knee isn't protected as well.
Would that mean with development as such as it is, that younger people are less likely to get injured than older people in terms of physical activity if it depends on the split-second patterning from the brain?
Well, I'm not sure of any evidence to prove what you're saying, but what is interesting, if we get back to the male versus female issue on the ACL injuries, what we are finding is that these women are especially predisposed right after they go through puberty. And what it may be is that their brains are not reacting to all these changes in their body fast enough, all these anatomic changes, and they're not prepared once they go through puberty. Their jumping style tends to change. When they land, they tend to land in a more vulnerable position for their knee, as opposed to men, where their knees tend to be more stiff when they land. Women tend to be a little more ligament dominant. They have a little bit more wobble in their knee. And this seems to set them up. If you look at the statistics, it's right when they're 15, 16, and 17 where the women are tearing their ACLs, and it's almost an epidemic.
There are a whole lot of different sports that we should probably refer to when we're talking about young kids and teenagers. You have mentioned to us prior to the show pole vaulting, baseball, cheerleading, football, and so forth. But I had a lot of soccer players. I had three soccer players in my house, and they did something that used to scare the dickens out of me. It was called heading the ball. This is my chance to ask you, was that okay for them? They turned out all right.
That's a great topic, and I have an interest in that as well, being a soccer player, and my kids also play soccer. I can remember back in high school when I used to practice juggling with my best friend, and one of the things that we used to do is head the ball back and forth, and we got quite good to the point where we could do it 500 times, you know, 20, 25 minutes until our necks got so tired we'd have to stop. Well, when I started reading about some of the studies that came out of Europe saying that soccer players, once they retire, tend to have some neuropsychological differences between controls, I got a little nervous. And what's good news for all the parents out there is that nobody has ever shown that heading the soccer ball once can cause any kind of brain damage. I mean, I feel fortunate. I did all that heading, and I made it through medical school and became a doctor. And the only one who thinks I'm crazy is my wife. Of course, she'd be the one who would know. But no one's ever shown that heading the ball once can cause a problem. There seems to be a lot of anxiety in the community because of some of these reports that came out, but not all science is good science. And if I could just briefly go over some of these early studies that came out of Europe, again, what they did was they looked at some neuropsychological tests in soccer players that were retired versus controls, and they found there were some differences, and they concluded, well, it must be from heading the soccer ball. Well, you just can't, it's not a cause and effect type of a study. There could be a lot of other things that could be causing those changes. It could be drinking history. It could be the fact that they used soccer balls that were leather that absorb water back in the 50s or 60s. It could be that some of these soccer players had head injuries that went undetected. So one of the things that we looked at when I was doing my sports medicine fellowship was, what is the incidence of concussions in soccer? And we found that it was fairly high at the elite level. I'm talking about college and professional soccer players. In our study of the ACC men and women soccer teams, we found that there was approximately one concussion per season per team. That's pretty high. So we said, well, you know, if there are changes down the road, is it really from hitting the soccer ball or is it from getting a concussion? You would think a concussion is obviously a much more serious head injury. So right now, we're trying to answer that study. We've obtained grant money from U.S. Soccer, and we're doing a prospective study where we are looking at all of the national team players when they come into training at the age of 16, and we're following them, doing neuropsych battery tests on them every year, comparing them to a group of controls, and we're going to follow them over 10 years. And we're also going to look at whether or not they've had a concussion, how much they drink, whether or not they've had anesthesia for surgery, and all these other variables. And hopefully that study will give us a better idea of whether or not hitting the soccer ball really is dangerous. So right now, we really don't know. No one's ever shown in the short term that hitting the soccer ball is dangerous, so I don't think we have to worry. I think that some of the preventive strategies that parents can take and coaches can take, when kids are young, number one, they use a smaller ball. They use a size 3 ball instead of the 5 ball that the adults use. Number two, we try not to stress heading at a young age because we just don't have the answers right now. So we don't make it a big part of practices. And if you watch kids when they play in the games at 6, 7, 8 years old, they really don't head the ball. So I definitely don't think there's a problem with the real young kids. Whether there's a problem when they get to junior high school and high school, we don't know the answer, but we're trying to figure it out.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on sports safety.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Barry Bowden about sports safety. We've talked about games a lot, but what about preparation for practices? Are stretches and warm-up exercises important for naturally active, wiggly kids?
Well, I think that stretching and warming up properly is important. I think it may be overrated to a degree. Young kids, their muscles are very compliant. You don't see too many young kids, you know, having a really serious muscle strain. Nonetheless, I do think it's important to warm up. I think the best way to warm up is just to take a slow lap around the field and not to go right into sprints or any kind of ballistic type of exercises at the beginning of the practice. But I think the best way to warm up is to take a slow lap or two, do some, you know, gentle jumping exercises, followed by some stretching before any kind of, you know, fast sprints, a really active play.
How about what kids wear? One of my sons played football in junior high school, and I remember having to pay $100 for a football helmet. Almost all sports have specialized equipment.
That's correct, and that equipment is important. I mean, if you look at football, there are standards on the football helmet. There is an organization called NOCSI up in Providence, Rhode Island, and they set the standards for certain types of equipment. Football helmet has been shown to be really important, and it's evolved quite a bit, especially in the 1970s. Before the 1970s, some of the helmets were not very protective. Then they came up with this standard that all the football helmets have to meet. And there should be a little label on the football helmets that it meets those standards. Since the 70s, with the improved football helmets, the incidence of head injuries concussions have gone down in football. So that's an important improvement. Now, there are certain agencies like the NCAA and the National Football High School State Associations that also make rules on what equipment is necessary. And there are a lot of specifics for each particular sport, which I can get into if you'd like. But the equipment is important for sure.
Well, now, how do the parents know that the teams are abiding by whatever is supposed to be optimal for the play?
And also, some of it has to fit certain ways. That was my problem with the helmet. What about shin guards? All those different kinds of things, the shoes and the outfits for wrestling, all that stuff.
Right. Well, I think that the coaches really have to play an active role here. And the parents need to rely on the coaches to a degree to become educated. At certain levels, coaches need to take a certification. I know at certain, you know, high school and college sports, there's a certain certification. So these coaches need to be knowledgeable on what is necessary. At the youth levels, you're right, the parents need to take a little bit more of an active role themselves and get educated, and it can be difficult. In some sports, like soccer, there really is no regulation on the shin guard. We actually looked into that. First of all, we looked to see how effective a shin guard is, and what we found was shin guards are effective in protecting against abrasions, bruises, contusions, but they're not always effective in protecting against fractures. If you collide legs with somebody with enough force, the bone can break, even with a shin guard on. The problem is, if you put a shin guard on that's too protective and too firm, then it can actually cause damage. So you can't get carried away with a protective device. I mean, if you have a shin guard that's made of metal and somebody kicks another kid with that shin guard, then they could hurt the other kid. So for right now, we limit it to what's available, you know, over the counter. I think as long as kids are wearing shin guards, they tend to be protected from the minor injuries. Thank goodness the major injuries are very rare.
When our cherub-faced kid announces he or she is going to join the school sports team or the little league soccer or baseball team or whatever, what should we look for in a coach?
That's a good question. I think the important thing is a coach who cares about the kids, a coach who's willing to make the commitment, a coach who understands at the youth level that participation is really important. Winning is not the most important thing. We're talking about exercise. We're talking about learning to function as a team. And so you want to get somebody who has the right mindset. We can't always expect our coaches to be the most knowledgeable about a sport, but as long as they're caring for the kids, as long as they're not pushing them unnecessarily, as long as they're loving, I think those are the critical factors of a good coach.
Dr. Bowden, that age-old favorite question of moms, be sure to drink enough. Did you drink enough? How much water did you drink before the game? Did you drink during the game, etc.? How much is enough?
Well, thank goodness for moms. That's for sure. I can say I often neglect the water aspect when I take my son to soccer practice, but my wife never forgets to remind us. It is important, especially if you're playing during the summer, especially if you're playing in the South, where it gets really hot and humid. You have to be careful. I mean, dehydration, heat-related illnesses are a definite concern. The most common area where you get into trouble is in football, because these football players are wearing all these pads. It's the fact that they're wearing extra equipment. It just adds to the heat. So dehydration is a serious problem. And you're right. Kids should come to practice well hydrated. They should definitely have a few drinks before they go out and play. What's the best type of drink? According to the experts, if you're participating in a sport for under 1 hour, water is sufficient. But if you're participating for over an hour, you really need to get the extra supplements and nutrients. You really need the sodium and potassium. And it's best to drink a sports drink, something like Gatorade or some other type of sports drink. The problem with just drinking water is that you're really not maintaining your electrolytes. And so you really need to maintain both the water and the electrolytes in your system.
Can you explain what electrolytes are?
Are basically chemicals in the body like sodium and potassium, and they're important in the cell to help regulate the cell functions. And if you just drink water, then you're not getting those supplements into your system, and you can develop other types of medical problems. So for anyone that's participating for greater than an hour, the sports drinks are key. Stay away from soda. Soda is carbonated. It basically fills you up, so you can't drink as much. So shouldn't be drinking sodas before or during practice sessions. The sports drinks are excellent.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on sports safety.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Barry Bowden about sports safety. What kind of symptoms might a young athlete have if he or she is showing a need for electrolytes?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if somebody is starting to become dehydrated, there are several different forms of dehydration. And one of the early signs of a heat stroke is that patients or athletes can sometimes become a little confused, a little dazed. Because the brain is so sensitive to dehydration, a patient can become a little confused, they can become a little delirious. And you got to make sure that you treat that patient immediately if that starts to develop. And how do we treat them? I mean, coaches really need to know a little bit about this too, because there's not always a doctor on the field. There's not always a trainer on the field. The best way to treat these is prevention. And like you said, you know, drinking before you go out and play, taking frequent breaks while you're playing. If you're playing during the summer, people often get into problems right at the end of the summer when they come back for a high school sport like football and they have three-a-day practices. They get into trouble if they're not used to the heat. So you have to go through a certain process of acclimatization where you get used to the weather. And so you shouldn't be practicing three times a day if you're coming from 80-degree weather going to 100-degree weather. You should be practicing maybe for a half an hour, you know, once or twice a day, and slowly increasing the time. You have to have a coach who's educated and is taking frequent water breaks every 15 minutes. If somebody does start to develop heat stroke, they show any signs of confusion, you need to take them out of the play. You need to take them to a cooler environment, take off their clothes, take off their equipment, fan them down, make sure they're drinking as much as possible. If there's a trainer there, they need to get an IV in the athlete and start hydrating the athlete, and then get them to the emergency room as soon as possible. But again, prevention is the key. Most of these can be prevented if you have an educated coach.
If kids are playing in cold weather, can they also be dehydrated?
I haven't seen that. I am not sure of any case reports of people getting dehydrated. I assume it can occur, but the big problem there is hypothermia. I mean, if you're playing in, you know, 20-degree weather, you can certainly get frostbite, fingertips, you know, on your nose, so you have to be careful there as well.
And those symptoms are tingling and things?
Losing sensation in the fingertips. And so you have to be careful not to be out too long, especially if it's snowy or wet conditions. You want to make sure that, you know, if you are playing and you have gloves on that, you know, they get wet, you need to take them off, you need to dry your fingers out, you need to change clothes frequently. But again, you got to be aware of the temperature. You got to be careful not to be out in that type of temperature for a really long period of time.
Even if you're active.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're active, it protects you to a degree, but it's not going to protect you 100%. But you're right. I mean, in circumstances like that, it's often the coach, it's often the spectators who are out at the game who get into trouble, not the athlete.
So parents have to take care of themselves.
Absolutely.
In lots of neighborhoods, the kids play mud football, you know, pickup basketball. Suggestions for their safety in those situations?
We see an awful lot of injuries that occur when kids are not supervised. When you're supervised and you have a coach, I mean, they usually have things under control. They have some education and know what to do, what not to do. Where kids often get themselves into trouble is at home when they're playing with other kids and they're not supervised. And a good example would be pitching. There are certain rules on the number of innings that a pitcher can pitch in Little League baseball. Well, that's very well regulated when you're out in a game or during practice sessions and there's a coach there. The problem is sometimes these kids go home and they're practicing by themselves and they may be pitching for an hour or two every day, which can cause harm to the shoulder. They can develop overuse injuries. So in those situations, it's really the parents who have to watch carefully over their kids and protect them.
As in so many different categories.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, we don't have any more time to go through any other questions, but what resources would you suggest for parents who want to pursue the subject a bit further?
Well, with the internet now, you can get access to just about anything. And a couple good places to start would be the American College of Sports Medicine, ACSM, the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine, AOSSM, and I know their website is www.sportsmed.org. The National Athletic Training Association, or NATA, has some excellent information for trainers and coaches. That's a good place to start. There are plenty of books out there. I'm not going to mention any, but it's easy to find these books for coaches, for parents. There's lots of information out there. I would encourage all the parents to, you know, take an active interest in protecting their children and getting involved.
Well, you have certainly helped all of us take an active interest and get involved in giving us a lot of information that we can start to work with. So, Dr. Barry Bowden, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show 199. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.